Hey, everybody. I've got a little bit of housekeeping here before we get into the episode about Instagram and Theology Beer Camp. So I've been getting more active on Instagram, and I just want to let you guys know, in case you want to see me make some videos where I look directly into the camera, I'm sharing some stories and posts about basically all the topics that we cover on this show over at Instagram.com/DanKoke. That's C-O-K-E, and the link is in the show notes. Also, Theology Beer Camp is returning in 2024, October 17th through 19th. The theme is Return of the God Pods. That is a Lord of the Rings reference, which should surprise nobody. I will be there alongside Brian McLaren, Diana Butler-Bass, The New Evangelicals, Bible for Normal People, Tony and Josh from GGCH, of course, Trip Fuller and Homebrewed Christianity, and a whole grip of others. And you can use the promo code RETURNOFYHP, all one word, for $25 off your ticket. Prices go up starting June 1st. That link will be in the notes. I hope to see a bunch of you guys there in October. It was a serious highlight of last year for me. My name is Dan Koch. Like many of you, I've been on a complicated faith journey for a number of years now. And while I tend to find myself on the progressive side of Christianity, my goal is not to make liberal converts. I want this show to be a resource for Christians to my right and to my left, as well as former Christians and non-religious folks, anyone who finds themselves asking difficult questions about God, science, prayer, fate, suffering, evangelism, and more. So many of us have been given bad answers to those good questions, often by people with pure intentions. I want to say that you have permission to take both Christianity and the modern world very seriously. And I hope to facilitate that by introducing you to people seeking God across the Christian spectrum, engaging hard questions in a multitude of ways. Thanks for listening. My guest today, Dr. Elaine Heath, is a heavy hitter. She goes into some of her CV, but let's just say this. She was the first woman dean of Duke Divinity School when she took that job. She's been a pastor. She's been an academic. She's been in administration. She's thought through a lot of this stuff very deeply for a very long time. And I'm really, really enjoyed this conversation with her, going through her five principles of what the church of the future needs to contain. Communities that do what? And she's got five excellent ideas, and we have a really great interactive sort of conversational thing going here today. I brought in psychology in a number of places where it seemed applicable or where I couldn't help but bring it in. A little bit of an impulsive, compulsive vibe there. But I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed having this conversation. Elaine Heath, thank you so much for being with me today. I'm pretty stoked about this conversation because you have a really concise and I will admit I like some structure. I love a good 5-point plan. Even though, you know, it can be sort of overdone in sermons and stuff, like as I get more and more into psychological research, I just realize that something like 5-point plans, like it's just necessary to get a certain number of people to understand what you're working on. People don't have time to listen to a 2-hour conversation, although I guess they do. They listen to podcasts, but you know what I'm saying. So I'm excited to get into this sort of like church of the future. But before we do that, I want to set the stage a bit. So I'd like to first ask you about, can you give us just some bare bones cliff notes of your own religious story or journey?
Sure. And I'm excited to be in conversation with you today. So thank you for the opportunity. I grew up in a non-Christian home, grew up in poverty, a lot of violence, a lot of deficits, left home when I was still a kid, as did my siblings. And I came to faith when I was 16. I was in my early 30s in a Pentecostal church when I experienced a call to ministry, and it was a fairly complex call. I've written about it here and there. And I knew that part of my calling was to ministry, hands-on ministry through pastoral work and innovative work. And the other part of it had to do with theological education. I had to go to school forever and ever and get prepared to do these things and then live into the call. And along the way, when I was in college, while my kids were in school, they were always in school and I was in school, I was very drawn to study the Reformation, the leaders of Reformations throughout the history of the church, especially the radicals of the Reformation. People like the Lollards and people like the Anabaptists, the ones who were really in favor of lay people having the work of the church, doing the work of the church, and the sort of anti-clericalism. When I was in seminary, I joined the United Methodist Church. I came out of the Pentecostal Church and joined the United Methodist Church, primarily so that I could get around all these gender barriers I was experiencing in answering my call. You know, always have to defend myself for having a call and that kind of stuff. And so that's how I became United Methodist. And over the years serving in United Methodist churches and then going into academia, my theological understanding evolved as well. So I started out in this very conservative Pentecostal environment. And today I would describe myself as a progressive Christian who loves Jesus but has serious questions about the institutions and some of the church's priorities these days.
Yep.
My attraction to the reformers, the mystics, the prophets, the saints has grown and grown over the years. And I understand now why, looking back, because I myself have work that is in the reforming and prophetic traditions with the church. So to make a long story quite short, today I'm ordained in the United Methodist Church. I'm an elder. I retired from the United Methodist Church last year to create more space in my life for doing innovative work. I'm thankful for the United Methodist Church that gave me a home and a place to answer my call. I worked in academia for many years. I was a professor of evangelism at Perkins School of Theology, and then I served at Duke Divinity School as dean and professor of pastoral and missional theology.
Wow.
And I retired from Duke in order to start Neighborhood Seminary, which is an innovative ministry to provide decolonizing missional and theological education for lay people. And I now serve as abbess at Spring Forest, which is an intentional community where I live with my husband and a bunch of friends, where we have a farm, and we're doing some pioneering work.
You know, it's interesting that you say as you get older, you appreciate the reformers, the sort of rabble-rousers more, because mm-hmm. I think that, like, all things equal, people tend to get more conservative as they get older. As they get, you know, later in their career, and they have things that they want to preserve or that they think are worth preserving, you know, it's obviously a stereotype, and
yeah.
It doesn't apply to everyone. But I'm wondering if that's been interesting. Maybe you've had the opposite experience of some of your friends, or I don't know. Just curious about that.
Yeah, that's a good observation. I guess I don't fit the stereotype very well. The mm-hmm. older I've gotten, the more inner and outward freedom I need and have found in order to be true to the calling that I have. And one of the things that keeps me going is being familiar with the lives of so many reformers, the prophets, mystics, and saints and martyrs who didn't slow down when they got older. In many ways, they came into their own in what we would call old age. What I would think of as they entered, you know, the time of being sages and the wise people. So, yeah.
That's one of the hallmarks of a wisdom tradition, is that there is usually some kind of acknowledgement that with age and time and experience, more wisdom comes.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes Christianity does a good job of acknowledging that. But in a lot of ways, I think especially in America, both for sort of conservative cultural reasons, but also for economic reasons
mm-hmm.
and sort of secular cultural reasons, like the things that just make us Americans, not American Christians. We really value youth. And mm-hmm. then in terms of the cultural conservatism, we really value, it's like youth and truth. If I was gonna, that's a nice little coin coined term. It's like either you're young and we'll value you, or you have access to some impregnable absolute truth from the past, and so it doesn't matter that you're young, you know. Or maybe those two things go together and they produce like people like Josh Harris, who then have these spectacular burnouts, or Mark Driscoll, where it's like, oh yeah, he's young and exciting and he's got the truth, so we're good. And it's like, no. A wisdom tradition would be like, hold your horses on both accounts.
Yes. You know? Yeah, that's right. And most of the world gets this. Indigenous people totally get this. I mean, wisdom is knowledge gained through suffering. Primarily, it's suffering and experience. You learn the way things are by the sort of messiness of living. And in most cultures in the world, the older people are, the more respect they have because they've gained wisdom from living. So I embrace the wisdom traditions. I think that's right. And it doesn't mean that older people are always wise. I know a lot of older people that need their heads cracked together.
Metaphorically,
of course. But, you know, that's not a guarantee that you're going to have wisdom. But understanding psychosocial, emotional, and spiritual development could go a long way to help us avoid unnecessary pain.
Well, and this is an interesting segue to my next question, which is about, you know, thinking about the church of the future. And and when I think about the blank of the future in our current times, I think young CEO billionaires, or, you know, a young up and coming physicist at Harvard, or a young, you know, it's usually not. And I guess there are some of the more like old guard astrophysicists who people will look to make sense of like what might come next. But we do have a preference for like fresh minds that are unencumbered by the assumptions of the past. But the entire conversation today is about the church of the future. And yet we've already started by rooting it in ancient wisdom, age, the lessons of suffering. I mean, already this is like a countercultural blank of the future discussion. You know what I'm saying? And maybe that is the prophetic. Maybe that is what that is.
Well, I think that's part of it because, and I'm going to speak to American Christianity, this is not globally true. It's true in too many places, that in our pursuit of the cultural values of youth and beauty, money, sex, and power, all in the name of, you know, being hip as Christian leaders or whatever, we have forgotten the ancient tradition that got the church through genocides, that got the church through, you know, persecutions and all kinds of things. Think of the pre-Constantinian church and the underground church in different times and places in the world. The church is being pushed way to the margins now here in the United States and in the Western world. It's being pushed to the margins where it needs to be. And it's losing its capacity to swagger around and tell people what to do. So now what is required from the church is to show up in the world in humility. And the mind of Christ, the great kenotic hymn of Philippians 2, to empty ourselves, to be the people who are for their neighbors, which Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote about in his work, you know, as the Nazis were taking power. That's what's called for from the church, for us to be a kenotic church, a church that gives itself away, that's about giving and not taking, that's about healing instead of harming. And that's going to require wisdom. It's going to require leadership from people who have knowledge gained through suffering, and people who have compassion, who have self-awareness, and who have capacity as healers. That's not to say that there's nowhere for young leaders. It's to say that we have to reorder our priorities. And the other thing about this is that I'm noticing is how local and small it is, how ridiculously small it looks relative to the need that's out there. Margaret Wheatley writes about times of culture collapse in her book, Who Do We Want to Be? Who Do We Choose to Be? She says, during times of culture collapse, which we're in right now is a culture collapse, what's needed is for good-willed people, I'm going to use my language, people who can love well, who care about their neighbors, who care about the future of planet Earth, to form what she calls small islands of sanity in the sea of chaos. And these are small, local, neighborhood-sized gatherings of people where generativity can happen, where compassion can be fostered, and a vision for the future. And these become the catalysts for a new day. That's the kind of community, that's the kind of leadership, the kind of ethos that we need now.
Yeah, and that's a really great kind of 30,000 foot view of where we're going with this conversation. You said the church is losing its swagger, its inability to sort of beat people over the head and give everybody its values. And, you know, I was thinking, like, what's interesting, it's not being pushed to the side in one half of the country right now. But then I thought, well, in a very meaningful sense, it is, because it's being pushed to the side by sociopolitical identity, which is now very clearly running the show on the right. And so the church might feel temporarily for maybe another 10, 15 years that it's got its swagger back. Look, churches are growing on the right. It might even feel to many people in those communities like a time of revival for America, which would then further entrench them in their sociopolitical ideology, right? Because it's seen as proof in the pudding that, oh, Trump is God's man, and this is, we are standing up as a persecuted remnant, despite the fact that we are the largest group in America, you know, like all of that stuff. But of course, the church, the teachings of Jesus, the teachings of Paul, the teachings of the prophets, and even Moses,
yes,
have less power in that half of the country than they used to. And now they all have to be twisted to fit a sociopolitical ideology. So it doesn't have its swagger. It's like, it's the last gasp, maybe, of a kind of sociopolitical power under the guise of the church that in 20, 30 years' time will be like the Christian right parties of Europe, which have, you know, 12% of the vote or something like that. There's always going to be people like that who have authoritarian tendencies and and are conservative religious folks, but they're not going to be 48% of the country anymore at some point, because the church, I mean, if it's hard to predict the future, but if it keeps up like this, the witness of the church to most young people is just like plainly gone.
Oh yeah.
On that side. So that's an interesting way of kind of putting those things together. And I don't think I'd quite thought of it that way.
Well, I think you're right about that, both in your predicting that 30 years from now, it's going to look really different. There'll be a significant shrinkage of power there. Also, there'll be the days of reckoning are going to come. And we're even seeing it now. Part of the reckoning is the shrinkage of the church. Part of the reckoning is accountability. We live in this surveillance culture where people can't get away with abuses of power without somebody filming it and then putting it on social media and the news and so on. So the accountability for domineering, abusive forms of religion, exploitive, predatory forms of religion, the accountability is coming. And what I think we've got to focus on is modeling the way of Christ in a way that's very simple, that's very oriented toward exactly what you said, the teachings of the prophets, the teachings of Jesus. I mean, how in the world can you read the Gospels, even the Sermon on the Mount, if we just limited ourselves to that? And how do you come up with these extravagant power plays? Yeah, you can't.
So many possible psychological rabbit holes to go down there, but I've gone down all of them before in previous episodes. So I'm gonna try and focus more on your approach, because Elaine, what I often do is I'll bring in, you know, how I'm thinking psychologically as I work on my own doctorate. But I want today to be more a theological conversation that draws on your work and this sort of vision for the future, because it's a very different lens. You know, I'm usually focused on explanatory power. Mm-hmm. Why are people acting a certain way? Why did my parents sell out for Trump? Like, how can I understand that? I'm not talking about my own parents, just for the record, in case they're listening. But, you know, questions like that people have, like, and that's how I got into psychology, was reading Jonathan Haidt around the time of Trump's first election, 2016. I'm going to try and turn my lens to the future with you and use my sort of theological imagination. And one way of talking about a good term for a church that has its swagger before it loses its swagger is Christendom, right?
Yeah, right.
As contrasted from Christianity, Christendom is, tell me if this is a good definition, any time in any place where Christianity has cultural power, maybe sufficient cultural power over some threshold to basically dictate or influence the primary social terms and political or economic terms of a culture, something like that?
Yeah. I mean, we could even distill it a little bit more. We could say anytime the church is functioning as empire.
Okay. Yeah. And that's good. But that can be kind of, empire can be kind of, buzzwordy for people and stuff, right? So when I think empire, I think of like the Roman Empire, of course, or maybe like imperial colonial Europe, right? Stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That is a much pithier and more compact statement than the free form one I gave. So you write that the church of the future, whatever it is, it has to focus on healing the wounds inflicted by Christendom.
Yes.
So you've kind of started mentioning them a little bit, but just give us a litany of those wounds.
Sure. Well, why we have to do this, I'll tell you what the wounds are, but I also want to say why. We have no moral authority to speak to our neighbors about God or about theology or anything else spiritual unless we start actively healing those wounds. We've lost our moral authority. We've lost our credibility. And so the language we have to speak first and foremost is language of practice more than words. And don't get me wrong, words are necessary too. But let's just go through some of these wounds that have been inflicted by Christendom, by the church showing up, acting like it owns the joint. It gets to take what it wants, use who it wants, discard as it wants, and determine all of the terms of who's in and who's out and who's going to suffer because they're out. The church aligning itself with political powers to get what it wants. So that's what I mean by Christendom. So first of all, there's the earth itself, our home. It's the home for every living thing here. God's good earth. This is my Father's world, the old hymn says. And so the church has been complicit in the rape and destruction of the earth through its theology, through its failure to speak out and take care of God's good earth. Now, there have, of course, been alternate voices. I think of John Woolman, the Quaker. He was the first one to name some of these things in the non-Catholic world, for example. But the church that heals the wounds of Christendom is going to be a green church. It's going to understand and be deeply involved in healing the wounds to the earth out of a sense of the earth being sacred. It belongs to God. And out of the sense that the earth is everybody's home. So that's the first set of things.
Yeah. So that's like, I have my notes here, your kind of five principles of what this future church looks like. And we're getting into the first one here. We're going to go through all five of these. And this first one is communities. You know, what is the church going to need to look like? It's going to need to be full of communities that honor and heal the earth. And this one is almost, it's so hard to sort of get our minds around it depending on sort of our upbringing and the actual situatedness of being an American in the 21st century. You know, it's hard to imagine it's hard to imagine something other than capitalism is one way of saying it. Mm-hmm. Another way of saying it is like a more psychological angle would be it's hard to imagine a world where most people don't just kind of choose the thing that is best for them and their family, mm-hmm. you know, regardless of what the sort of global consequences of that are. Mm-hmm. And so this one just feels so uphill to me. And maybe I can catch some of your theological fire and vision to flatten that out in terms of my own understanding. I mean, do you feel that same sort of uphill thing, or because you're involved in an intentional community that is actually healing your little plot of earth that you're on, do you have more hope?
I have hope, but I'm also a realist. Climate change is devastatingly quick, and we're all aware of this, you know. So where we have to turn to gain the wisdom we need, or to flatten the hill, as you're saying, we need to turn to some of our own Christian traditions. I think of the Franciscan tradition, for example, Bonaventure. I think of the ecofeminist theology of Sally McFaig with the earth as God's body. She meant that metaphorically, but that that God is with us in the earth. This is sacred. And then to indigenous wisdom traditions, where this is not, this is a no-brainer. You know, it's Father Sky and Mother Earth. This is a way of thinking about our interconnectedness with all living things and with all material things. So the work is definitely rigorous. It's going to take time. And for some of us, it's going to be a lot harder than for others. But we have to go there. We have to go there.
I want to spend a minute on the indigenous thing, because I think a few things come together here in a way that is only recently becoming clear to me. I have a friend who's indigenous, and her family experienced an actual loss of a family member related to one of these indigenous schools, the kind of re-education type schools. Mm-hmm. Literally lost, somebody lost their sister to a disciplinary action through just this insane sort of cultural hegemony and cultural imperialism of ripping these kids out of their communities, making them Christians, making them speak English, forbidding mm-hmm. them to speak their own languages. And that's maybe it might be the most pointed example we have on our soil of Christendom as empire, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And all done in the name of, well, this is where the psychology comes in. We might say all done in the name of a certain kind of theology, but I'm a realist about human psychology. And I would say also for those who were in economic power, the theology was convenient for them to put that stamp on the thing they already wanted to do economically.
Yeah.
Because their incentives were to make the nation wealthy, make themselves wealthy, keep their power, just the same incentives that people always have who are in power. But it's so interesting that they also have sort of the most sustainable and an incredibly nuanced understanding of nature and sort of the value of cycles and the need for sustainability with anything cyclical. And so, the indigenous, the experience between Christianity, Christendom, and the indigenous people of North America is where so much of it comes together in such a heartbreaking way.
Yeah, it's so true. When I think of doing constructive work in this area, not only do we need to be accountable and to mourn and do reparations for the damage, we can never really do the... We must not forget it. I mean, that's part of that work for us to do is to reclaim the voices and the stories and to honor the people. But I'm thinking right now about some resources that can help us as we do this. It's part of what I think God is doing is calling us in our repentance, you know, our turning around and going in a life-giving direction. It's to turn around in humility, and instead of being the white people who are showing up and saying what everything's going to be, now we're learning from our indigenous sisters and brothers a much more sane and sacred view of the world. So we're just learning in humility. And some of the resources that can help us with this, I think of the work of Richard Twiss, the late Richard Twiss, who wrote Rescuing the Gospel from the Cowboys, along with a number of other books. And so he's a Christian. He was a Christian Native American who really had a gift for bringing the worlds together while holding us accountable as white persons for what has happened. I think about the book Braiding Sweetgrass. It's not a Christian book, but it's written by an indigenous person who's a scientist and is also bringing forth the wisdom of her traditions around what we can learn from plants, from the natural world. So these bringing these things together. So those are two resources I can think of immediately. I could name a bunch of other things too, but that's part of our work is learning from indigenous traditions and learning in humility, not in ways that are culturally misappropriating anything, but that is truly learning in humility from the wisdom traditions.
So this second principle you have, so the first one was communities that honor and heal the earth. And the second principle that the future church will need to be comprised of is communities that embody a God who is just like Jesus, compassionate, friends with all the wrong people, etc.
Yes.
What's so interesting about this is that, you know, anytime someone says like Jesus, my interpretive or hermeneutic spidey sense goes up, and I'm like, okay, which Jesus are they talking about? Because you've got Mark Driscoll's Jesus from the book of Revelation, who's like a tattooed badass covered in blood up to his knees. And that Jesus is really different than the Jesus presented in any of the four gospels, but they even present Jesus differently between the gospels. So, I mean, I kind of want to ask like a nerd question of like, how do we even sort of ensure that we have like what many reasonable people would agree upon as a sort of a composite picture of Jesus? I don't mean like the historical Jesus. I just mean even just something we can get our hands around and like more or less agree with any kind of basic biblical literacy. Yeah.
Right, right. No, that's a great question. It makes me think of Philip Yancey's book about all the different Jesuses, and Brian McLaren did some things about the different Jesuses. So here's what I think is helpful. I think Jesus, the way Jesus lives in the Gospels, we have to look at how he actually behaves. It's the practices. And that becomes the interpretive key for what God is like, because Jesus shows us exactly what God is like. And what we have to do is pay attention to Jesus's practices, his behavior, even to interpret his words. So his behavior becomes the interpretive key. And as Christians, as we read all of Scripture, have any kind of interpretation of Scripture that violates how Jesus shows up and behaves in the Gospels, then we're getting it wrong. So that's my conviction.
Actually, can you motivate that a little bit? I think that's a very interesting approach to take, that it's kind of like saying you can ask someone what they love, but the better thing to do is to check their bank statement. And like, you know, their credit card statement will be a lot clearer about what they value than what they will tell you themselves. And I'm sure my own credit card statement is no exception. I mean, that could be one way of thinking about going with the behavior. Another possible way would be, as myself, a non-inerrantist about Scripture, as I imagine you are as well. Mm-hmm. So when human beings are putting these things together, and if and when they are distorting God's true nature or Jesus's true intentions, they can less easily distort Jesus's behavior than his words.
Yes.
Words can get moved around. We can put words in different times and places, mm-hmm. but like, did he really accept death on a cross and didn't fight back? Well, a version where he tries to get down off the cross, you know, is not going to fly. Or a version where he doesn't flip over the tables is not going to fly with the people who were there. Whereas, when did he say that? Or who did he, you know, you'd get less pushback. I don't know if that's true, but that's what's going through my mind.
Well, I just think it's helpful. And I mean, my coming to this conclusion, after being trained in a school where I was taught a particular way to interpret Scripture and so on, you know, my master's degree, I think it's come out of my own psychological development and healing from a lot of violence. I grew up in a violent family. I experienced a lot of violence, had to do a lot of work to heal. I mean, that's a lifelong journey, right? And I learned as even a young child, not to listen to what the people are saying, but to watch them all the time. You've got to watch and see what's happening and get really good at reading the room. And so I'm watching Jesus in the Gospels and reading the room. And that becomes my key, because Jesus reflects to us what God is like, what the unseen, what kind of God God is. And so if we would immerse ourselves in even just one gospel, but definitely, I mean, it's best if we do all the gospels, and we just kind of pay close attention and reflect together in our small groups, how is Jesus behaving here in this chapter of Mark? How's he behaving in this chapter of Luke? What the heck's going on with those pigs and the guy in the tombs? How's he behaving? How are his disciples noticing how he's behaving? And what's going on here? And so we develop a composite picture of what God's priorities are as we watch Jesus move through the world and suffers a lot. And this gives us all kinds of information about how we are called to move through the world as communities, as individuals. One of the things we notice about Jesus moving through the world, he's not willing to burn up people who don't believe in him or want to follow him. His disciples want to do that, and then he just really chews them out and kind of accuses them of having a bad spirit, you know. So this is the one time in the Gospels, you know, in Luke, where they have this exact situation of what kind of God is God? Does God want to burn up people that don't believe in Jesus? And the answer is no. that God's appalled by it. If we believe Jesus is both divine and human, Jesus is God showing up in the world and is not like that. Jesus is drinking out of the Samaritan woman's cup. You know, he's doing all these things. And so that gives us a lot of clues about what is expected of us.
Yeah, I mean, just off the top of my head, thinking about Jesus's behavior, you know, purity tests and sort of the purity laws angle of the Judaism in his day, Jesus was pretty uninterested in. We have words put into his mouth that he may or may not have said about, I'm not here to abolish the law. If anybody leaves, it takes out one jot or tittle. That happens to be in Matthew, which is written to a Jewish audience. We may put a little bit of a, okay, there's a question mark around how he thought about all the purity restrictions, but his behavior is pretty well flaunting them all
there
the time.
There you go. Constantly. In fact, he was not an ascetic. You know, well, how come his disciples fast and yours don't? And he's like, well, the day will come for them to fast. And he's accused by his detractors of being a drunk and a glutton.
Right.
And there's some evidence. I mean, he's always eating and drinking with people. He's not fasting. He forgets to wash his hands. You know, he's just not that. He's not an ascetic.
But he does pray. He does take time in silence away from everyone all the time. He's retreating to pray alone in the wilderness. That is such, I think that this is just my own ego speaking, but like I like the Jesus who alternates between a really wonderful semi-drunken meal with people and then leaving them behind entirely to go be silent and pray. Yeah. That is a pretty good description of my Christian life. And, you know, but I think in a kind of an incidental personality driven way, less than I really have something to be proud of or whatever. But yeah, that's really interesting. I just want to keep saying that this behavior as the key to interpreting the Jesus of the Gospels is such an interesting, I love it. Can I ask you one pedantic question about it though?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would imagine you're going to lean more on the synoptics than John, just because they're closer. Like, and if you want to know, like, what behaviors did Jesus of Nazareth take? Then I would think you'd want the Synoptic Gospels more than John, where there's a lot more editorializing. Everything's moved around. Is that true, or would you counter that?
I counter it. I love the Gospel of John. It's the mystical. It's the mystical gospel, right?
Yeah.
There's so much for us to learn there, too. Even going back to behaviors, the wedding at Cana, speaking of drunks and gluttons, you know, here is Jesus with his mother, and we find Jesus she's like, go do whatever he tells you to do. And he says, my time hasn't come yet. He's very human there in his relationship with his mother, you know, and I find that helpful too, the sort of normalizing of he's a son and has a mother and they have a, yeah. So no, I wouldn't say that I prefer the synoptics over John. I think they all belong together. John helps us to interpret a lot of things.
Okay. That's interesting. All right. That rabbit trail ended. So we're back to, so we've, at the point we're in point number two, communities that embody a God who's just like Jesus. And now we've talked about, well, how do we come to an idea of what Jesus looks like? And we've sort of answered that. And so then you were already kind of moving this way, but like now we want to apply what we find there to God. So maybe give us some takeaways of like, just speak about God now. So from your impression of who Jesus was, what's God like?
God is humble, vulnerable. Vulnerable means capable of being wounded. We see this in Jesus. God is compassionate, suffers with us. God is empathetic. God is not vindictive. God is always looking for the ones who are out there struggling and suffering, marginalized. You just find this compelling love of God. I always think of the servant parable of Julian of Norwich in her series of 16 visions and how the servant who represents both corporate humanity and Christ, the servant in that parable, what we see, I'll just give you the interpretation without going into the parable. We see a God in Christ, who loves humanity so much because God in Christ created humanity and loves Christ, loves us so much that it, that God is bound to us forever with this love, can't bear to be away from us. So when we descend into hell, God goes into hell with us. When God rises from hell, God pulls us with God. We see this represented in the Orthodox icon of the resurrection, where Christ is in hell pulling Adam and Eve up out of these coffins, and death is kind of bound up and can't have its way anymore. And that represents Christ pulling corporate humanity up out of hell. So this is the kind of God God is. For us to be communities of faith who image that kind of God, we too are bound to Christ out of love and growing trust. And wherever Christ goes, we go, because we're bound to Christ. So we're constantly descending into hell with our neighbors and coming up out of hell with our neighbors. I mean, for yourself, as someone who's doing a doctoral work in psychology, for my sister, who's a therapist, my sister who is, she used to be in the Orthodox Church, and now she loves Jesus, but is not part of an institutional church. She sees her work with her clients as descending into hell with them and coming up with them, even though she doesn't use religious language with her clients unless they use religious language and want to use these concepts. And so the church that reflects that kind of God is that kind of church. Its mission is to go to hell.
How different that is than the kind of triumphalist, you know, spiritually bypassing negative emotions, you know, health and wealth or health and wealth adjacent, you know, God's favor, all that language, that kind of theological vision, which is popular in many corners of American Christianity, is so anathema to the idea of no. Like, our job is to descend into hell with our neighbors, like Jesus did for everybody. It also puts a different lens on some of the conversations around persecution, and this sort of like soft P persecution around, well, these woke people want me to change my language, and, you know, what about my rights? You know, all that stuff. It's like, well, if your job is to go to hell with your neighbors, then probably the better question is like, why are these groups of people demanding this stuff? What is their experience? Yeah. In what ways have they been in hell?
Exactly. And,
right. But that is also like, I mean, what we're dancing around here, Elaine, is we're talking about a pretty high level of maturity and personal development.
Yes.
And I just want to call that out for what it is. That's, of course, my lens and the language that I would use for it. But like, most people don't get there. I mean, the way is narrow. This is one of my favorite applications of personal applications of the way is narrow is like, yeah, most people don't get all that mature, not the kind of maturity required to really be a Christ follower. So there's a heavy dose of realism that comes with a doctoral psychological education as you learn about what actually works and how much it works and how much people have to have internal motivation and how little you can change them and you know, all this stuff, right? Yeah. So I guess this is why I'm interviewing you, to pepper all of that with some hope and some a more of a theological, future-oriented lens to get beyond what I can imagine in this moment, you know?
We could throw up our hands and say, you're going to have too few people who follow this path because people don't get to that level of maturity. Most people don't. I mean, we could look at it that way and be fooled by thinking we have to have large numbers of people who take the gospel seriously. We could also be fooled by thinking you have to be old and, you know, a really unusual person. You have to be special. You have to be Mother Teresa. None of that's true. You know, in the early church, in the pre-Constantinian church, so many of the martyrs were young people, were teenagers and people in their 20s who gave their whole lives for this, for following Jesus. And when you study these reform movements I mentioned earlier, you find that so many of those reformers who were put in prisons and suffered for their faith, were burned at the stake and all kinds of things, were young people. And you look at the underground church in different parts of the world at different times, you know, in China and in Russia and other, you know, places where there are dictatorships and Christianity was outlawed and such. And you find these incredible stories of young people who gave their all because they loved Jesus and followed Jesus. There are enough examples for us that belie the thought that you have to be old and wise and special in order to follow the way of Jesus. I also think about how just a few people who are taking the gospel seriously can really change the world for good. So the beginnings of Methodism, for example, you've got John Wesley and his brother Charles and John's friends, and they're all kind of uptight and they want to have a holy club. And you know, it's just these college guys. And and at first, you know, Methodism was mostly poor people, and but this movement had a dramatic impact and did a lot of good, especially in its early to mid years and before it kind of began to accommodate and become prosperous and so on. I think about Quakers, and Quakers have always had a huge impact on the world, way out of proportion to their tiny number of people.
Totally.
Because of their commitments to the environment and justice. It doesn't bother me that what's happening now, this new Reformation, this new thing that God is doing, is small, it's grassroots, it's very localized, and has a lot of people nobody ever heard of.
Yeah, I think for me there's a real tension because my personality is such that I'm so drawn to the bigger ideas. I'm so drawn to systematizing and synthesizing things.
Yeah.
Like one of the projects that I really hope I can be involved in the years ahead, in the decades ahead, is a kind of a collective imagining of like, what can we learn about church practice from science? Like, what can we be humble about ecclesiologically and confident about scientifically, and be willing to rethink some of that stuff and figure out what's really working for people? Where is it actually leading to flourishing? Can we then humbly learn from that research and, you know, make changes? But I'm thinking about it as like a, you know, I want an Esalen Institute, you know, once a year we get the best minds and I want to be one of those minds, you know, like that's where I go, right? That's how I default. I've been a public person my whole life. You know, but then I can turn that around. I can switch it and I can go, okay, like, could my family be involved in a local church community that just looks for, like, that just does this stuff well and doesn't shy away from the pain and the suffering, holds space for people's wounds and their trauma and draws their playbook from the Gospels? And yeah, I could do that. And that is like the level of ambition is much, much lower, but actually it would be harder for me to do that than it would be for me to go be a very distinguished thought guest at the Institute. That's easy. That is where I want to be, you know?
Well.
That's like getting drunk and having a cheeseburger. That's not hard to do. You know?
That's hilarious.
It would take some work. I mean, I would need to be rigorous and I would need to do good work and, you know, I'd do a bunch of research, and it's not like that's not valuable. It's not like that's not work, but compared to loving my neighbor and going descending into hell with the single mother down the road.
Yeah.
That's way harder to do than being a Christian thought leader or whatever you want to call it, you know?
Oh yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah. You can have a lot of smoke and mirrors when you're a Christian thought leader, but so the way of Jesus decenters our egos. It just does.
Yeah.
And being in a small faith community that's showing up to one another and to our neighbors, and we're showing up to one another for our neighbors, with our neighbors. And we think of there's just us. There's not an us and them. We're just us. And we're here in our neighborhood. That costs you everything. And it has infinite reward. It does decenter your ego. And the way you structure your faith communities can make a big difference in helping facilitate the decentering of ego. So if we structure our faith communities so they don't become cults of personality and that sort of thing, where there's really shared power and there's deep humility toward one another and truthfulness and so on, that can help the process. So we have much to learn from healthy monastic communities. I mean, monastic communities can be as dysfunctional as anything, you know, but that's part of what God is raising up for us to learn from too, as far as what is needed today for us to do our work faithfully.
Let's move to number three, the type of church communities we need for the future church are communities of belonging. In other words, there is no more us and them. There is only us. Now, Dr. Heath,
yes,
this is where you might get some psychological pushback from me, but in a way that I hope, again, so far you're like undefeated in bringing some theological hope and vision to my jaded, psychologically informed soul. So I'm excited to talk about this one, and I'm just giving you a heads up.
Okay.
So how do we, where I would like to start, I don't know if you would let me jump in here to sort of give us a framework, is what is us and them doing for people that keeps them going to church under the rubric of us versus them? If we don't understand that, then we won't actually be able to create a viable alternative. We're just like theologizing in the dark, basically, or, you know, idealizing some idea we've had, some precept. But we should first understand, like, why does this work for people? And then I'm going to go to evolutionary history, and this stuff is pretty hardwired, and that's the cynical part of me. But so if I start there by asking you, what do you think it's doing for people? That it is so common that a religious group has an us and a them. How do you think about that?
One of the basic human needs is to belong, And the way this works is that by having and fearing and wanting to resist and overcome common enemies can create a sense of belonging. So if there's an us and a them, we got to watch out for them. We can't let them in. We can't be shaped by them. We're pretty sure they have nefarious agendas, and I could go on and on about it, right? Whoever the them is. Mm-hmm. It could be the them of the other denomination that we think is trying to get the best of us, take our people away. It could be the them of another racial group. It could be the them of another sexual orientation, another class, socioeconomic class of people. You know, it could... A xenophobia, you think about all the isms and phobias that divide people, all these us's and them's. Okay, so there's real power in the us and them, and it's the power of fear. And the take the power of fear and the need to belong in it, and this is how it works. So I'm thinking about Willie Jennings' recent book, After Whiteness. And he says that the number one thing that higher education of all kinds should be concerned with, particularly higher education in theology, is to teach belonging, to cultivate belonging. And he talks about how we've failed. We've definitely failed in the Western world. We have a white masculinist agenda that's aligned with the powers. And so to create communities of belonging where there's no more us or them is a radical countercultural move to make. It's also the way of Jesus. And what we have to give up to do this is to give up the fear motivation and be transformed into a love motivation, and the love of God being aligned with the love of God for all people, for the whole world. I mean, that's at the most basic level. And then we function out of that love instead of out of that fear. We find in the mystical traditions of the church, you know, I think of many mystics, but we could take Julian of Norwich. We could take St. Francis. I mean, there are a bunch of them. But this awareness of the unicity of all things, that we all belong to each other. I mean, we're all interconnected. This is something that's proven in science, and I'm no scientist. My knowledge of science is extremely small, but appreciative. And we know from physics that, yes, all matter is connected. All things are connected energetically. So we need to learn how to do this, especially now with our world so polarized. It It's not easy work, but this is the call.
Beautiful. There's a fun episode for patrons recently on the patron-only feed. Tony Jones and I, who have been doing these response episodes to the Mars Hill podcast over the last year, we started up another little mini-series called the Generation Gap Culture Hour, and it's a little bit of an experiment, but we are responding to other kind of current events in the American Christianity sphere. We've got Josh Gilbert, our editor and producer, on the mic with us. We are responding to deconstruction TikTok accounts. We're responding to prominent news articles. In this episode, we responded to that big Gospel Coalition article about deconstruction that went around a few months back. And it was a fun time. And so if you'd like to hear that episode, you can become a patron, $5 a month. Patreon.com/Dan Koch. That also gives you access to the Facebook group for patrons only. And Josh grabbed out a little clip from the Generation Gap Culture Hour. And here is that clip. It's very hard to know things in the world. Anyway, let's put a pin in that. I'm sure we're going to come back to
it. I'm just going to work really hard at, I really not need to not be so pro-Semitic. Dan's worried that I'm working too hard at not being anti-Semitic.
We've talked about this. You made this claim on Trip's podcast many years ago. The first thing I ever heard you on, and I talked to Pete Enns about it, and like, I'm with Pete on that one, and you disagree, and that's fine. And it's fine. I don't care. We're still buddies, but
a lot of evangelicals are supersessionists. It's true.
It is true.
A lot of liberal Christians are too.
I don't believe that I would fall under the category of supersessionism, except in some kind of boring definition of like more truth comes out later in time or something like that, mm-hmm. but not, I know what you're talking about. I don't, I'm probably not even orthodox enough to be supersessionist, my guess. It's like a not applicable would be in that.
Most liberals hate the Old Testament and just assume that it wouldn't be there.
I don't hate it. Oh my gosh. All right, moving on. I got to shut this old man up. Okay, we're going to skip.
So if you'd like to hear the rest of this episode, patreon.com/Dan Koch, and back to my conversation with Elaine.
I want to actually just shed a little bit of light from the psychology of religion research on this question too, and get your feedback from that. Mm-hmm. If we're doing a numbers game, it's hard to know. Actually, I think that we tend to think that big churches must be sort of fear-based. They're about saving souls from hell, saving yourself from hell. I think there's some recent work on megachurches, for instance, by Jim Wellman here at UW, that complicates that picture. But the thing that gets closest to what you're talking about in the literature is this distinction between intrinsic and extrinsic religion. Mm-hmm. So extrinsic is like, I'm religious because of some external motivator. And this can often be kind of fear of death, fear of hell, fear of judgment of God, fear of my peers, fear of my parents, letting people down, whatever. And then intrinsic, which is like, I am religious because because religion is where I find my values and it is in line with my values. I feel personally motivated to be a Christian or a Buddhist or a Muslim. You know, I have desires to do it. And so I do it. And that's closer to what you're describing as the love motivation. And one thing that's really that is becoming clear to me from this research, but that I want to know so much more about, the intrinsic stuff is more correlated than the extrinsic stuff with all the benefits of religion. So all the health benefits, the mental health benefits, the disease, prevention, the healing from trauma, the fewer antisocial behaviors, fewer risky behaviors. All this stuff is more correlated strongly with intrinsically motivated religion than extrinsically motivated religion. So we do have a model that, like, that's actually the kind we want. Now, maybe a bunch of people in these churches that on the surface are extrinsically motivated, the wrath and judgment of God, I actually think are not, don't buy that, or they don't focus on it for whatever reason. It could be their personality, could be their experience. And they actually just go and have an intrinsic faith. You know, they hear the pastor give his hateful thing about homophobia, and they might be a little homophobic, but it's just not the reason that they're there. So I don't know. But then on the numbers game, if I think about churches that have sort of doctrinally tried to instantiate this, like Unitarian Universalists or something, I'm like, well, that's not, hasn't really worked. It doesn't really pan out numerically anyway. And if it doesn't pan out numerically, is it a good model? I still struggle with that stuff because, you know, it's sort of like you'd want a good therapy treatment to work for most people. You don't, you know, with a therapy treatment, you would not be satisfied to say, well, we have this little pocket of people for whom it works, and we'll just be happy with that. No, you want to be rigorous and make sure you're really getting at the thing. Okay, I'm rambling. Your response to any of that, Elaine?
My response, if we take Jesus seriously, if we take the gospel seriously, we are called to love one another as the Father has loved Jesus and Jesus has loved us. It's very simple, really hard, really hard. But that's the call, is to live a life of love. He said, he quotes the Shema, what are the great commandments? To love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And when they say, yeah, but who's the neighbor? You know, got these insiders and outsiders. And he picks the outsiders.
Yep.
That's your neighbor right there. Yep. The person you love to hate and think you're doing God a favor. That's your neighbor.
Yep.
So, and I guess I'm just an old fashioned person in this way that I take that very seriously. That's the call. And I take seriously the scientific literature that all things are interconnected. I take seriously that my behavior, your behavior, anybody's behavior has ripple effects on all sorts of things, whether we know it or not, consciously. So what does it mean to show up in the world, live a life of love, of doing what I can and being who I can to generate goodness in the world, to generate community in the world, to heal that which is broken?
I think you're obviously right. I mean, you are. Like, that's, you're obviously right that that is my job as a Christian.
Yeah.
And that is my personal job. And the other stuff is, I guess, largely speaking, more of academic interest, like truly. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting. It gives me a little bit of hope that, like, a bunch of people in churches that we think are extrinsically motivated, are fear motivated, that mm-hmm. a bunch of the individuals in those churches are not, don't buy that. Because when they take surveys, they sure seem like they're intrinsically motivated, you know, at least a big chunk of them. And so maybe what we think is like an insurmountable new form of church is like not that insurmountable. But yeah. There's already a bunch of people in those churches who would be perfectly happy with it. And what we really have is like a donor structure or a loudest voice structure, you know, like squeaky wheels getting the grease.
Yep.
And there's some real theological challenges in a lot of those worlds. But I think about like a Foursquare or something. Like Foursquare has some theological beliefs that I don't believe that are to my right and whatever. But then they also were like ordaining women, you know, like 100 years, whatever, many decades ago.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think you could get a lot of people in there who are like, oh, you want to make this church, like, you want to change 30% and make it healthy?
Yeah.
Cool with me, you know?
Yeah.
Now, some churches, it'd be a lot more than 30%, especially these ones that are driven by power-hungry narcissists with complete control. I mean, there's really nothing you can do except get those people out. Yeah. So there's a big, big continuum where churches might fall. But I don't know. I guess I'm just saying, like, there might be a way to meld my two lenses here of like what I'm personally called to. It doesn't matter if I get invited to the big think tank stuff with the think tank stuff. I don't know. Maybe there is a little bit of, maybe I can synthesize them in my own life a little bit.
Maybe you can.
Jeez.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's move to principle number four. What we need to see in the church of the future are communities that give themselves away, in parentheses, repenting of all forms of mission, evangelism, and church that are predatory, manipulative, exploitative, etc. Obviously, we've talked about indigenous practices and those re-education schools being, you know, about as bad as it gets on that continuum. I mean, there's some probably religious motivated genocidal stuff with the army, but that was a little bit less clear that that was Christianity, right? That's like the U.S. government and maybe some of those leaders are using Christian language, but the Christian re-education schools are like Christian. Yeah. That's like straight up the church doing it. I think of the missions in Latin America and California as well as being like, yeah, that's just bad Christianity,
you know, right?
And then on the further, like on the softer end of the continuum is like a story I often tell is when my mom and I went to a thing that a friend was involved in California. They were giving away backpacks to underprivileged families as school was kicking in with full of school supplies. But you had to listen to the sermon before you would get the backpack. And that's like, that's manipulative. It's not what the Catholics would have probably done if it were them. And they said, hey, we're the Catholics down the street. Here are the backpacks. Here's the times that we meet. Feel free to join us, which would be a non-manipulative way of giving stuff, right? So all the way from re-education camps to bait and switch, you know, public presentations and everything in between. I guess I don't need to like answer the question for you. I feel like I'm talking too much. So tell us what you're thinking about this stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is the extreme of the cultural genocides and the literal genocide, you know, the genocides of indigenous people. But then we have things in the church now, things that seem subtle or maybe you don't even notice them, but things like calling people giving units, referring to your church members as giving units, as if they were cows or something. I've done a lot of work with church planters, and I've planted new faith communities myself a number of times. And I remember some years ago, we were discussing when a church is sustainable and what you need for a new church start to actually be considered successful. And the mark of success was for it to have enough money to support a full-time pastor with nice benefits. And so, which brought to mind the words of Ezekiel warning shepherds who eat the sheep, you know. Like, really, that's the mark of actually doing what Jesus called us to do, is to be able to provide a salary and benefits for a person with a master's degree. Really? There are so many ways that this plays itself out in our ecclesial imagination and practice. And we have to repent of all that. We have to repent of any kind of evangelism through force or trickery or shaming the hell out of people, you know, whatever it is that we're trying to do. And I think of a phrase I heard from Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove and William Barber, where they said, no, we need to practice evangelism through fascination because of the way we're showing up in the world.
Evangelism through fascination. Yeah, that's like they'll know you are Christians by your love, right?
Yeah, there we are. We're at a campfire with a guitar singing that song. Yeah.
That's more your generation than mine, Elaine. We're the generation where the campfire songs stopped being effective. And then, you know, our kids, maybe it'll come back like Mom Jeans and they'll think it's effective again when they get tired of SoundCloud rap. So, yeah, that is that's good. That is also hard.
Very hard. I mean, one of the features of that way of being the church in the world is something that Dietrich Bonhoeffer recommended, and that is, this is in Letters and Papers from Prison, is that clergy give up salaries, that churches give up all their buildings, take their physical resources to support the needs of the poor in their community. And clergy, of course, he's in, you know, their state church and so on, but he's saying the clergy need to have a regular job in the secular world like everybody else. And this is what we need to do. He's writing this in the 1940s from prison. He's a young man, by the way. He was a young man. So the way forward for this, and economic necessity is making this happen already anyway.
It is. That's a very interesting angle. Yeah.
Yeah. Smaller faith communities led by teams of people. Maybe one of those people has a theological degree. We hope some of them have some kind of formation that can be helpful, but not being paid. So being a pastor won't be a career choice as much as a spiritual gift exercised in the community. And it's amazing when the clergy are not getting paid for what we're doing, how it clarifies things and opens up space for us to give ourselves away.
Yeah, a study that I would love to see, I doubt this exists, but it would be really great, is like some work around what are the different incentives, what's the different phenomenological lived experience of lay pastors versus paid pastors. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you don't know this about me, but my own research is in spiritual harm and abuse. Mm. And I wonder how much of that is prevented by having lay pastors. Certainly not all. You certainly have people who are so strong in their theological convictions that the fact that they don't get money from it will not prevent them from abusing people with those convictions.
Yeah.
But the people who really want to amass power, you just can't if there's no money involved. If you have to be doing another job, there's such a ceiling on that. But I really wonder what the lived experience is. A concern I have for that model is that pastors do a bunch of shit work that no one else wants to do, that is simultaneously difficult. It's emotionally difficult. I'm talking about being bedside for cancer diagnoses. I'm talking about burying people in communities of color or under-resourced communities. Pastors end up becoming basically paralegals. Mm-hmm. And giving free legal advice, free tax advice. Mm-hmm. The experience of white and black pastors in America, there's some research around that is being really, yeah, is a big differential. And in that sense, like, pastors need to get paid. Like, you have to pay someone to do these things. You might as well pay a pastor to do them. Someone who's not primarily doing them for a profit. Mm-hmm. You don't really want like bedside mourners and for hire. You know what I mean? Like, there's a weird... There are some issues. There's some tough stuff. And I want to acknowledge that pastors really do a lot of shit detail. But then they also run little nonprofits whose main goal is to keep them and maybe one other person employed. Like, that's the main business goal. And that does seem silly.
Yeah.
And like you, most of those people could probably make more money just doing something else 30 hours a week. But then who's going to the bedside in the hospital? Mm-hmm. Is that chaplains? You know, I don't know. That's where it gets complicated for me. And I don't need to solve all of this, of course, that we're not at Esalen Institute solving all the problems of the church right now. We're just chatting. But I don't know. What do you think about either of those things? The sort of the lived experience of the two.
Yep.
Have you done both kinds?
Yeah.
Have you been? Okay. Well, then you can shed some light on the...
Yeah.
You know, it's anecdotal, but I'd love to hear what were the different lived experiences for you between being a paid minister and a lay minister?
So as a paid minister in the United Methodist Church, what I found was in my congregations, there was very high expectation for the pastor to be the minister and the people they're just over there. You know, they might have some committees or something, but really the work of praying and the work they expect it's like your work is a job, and they think of it that way. There is, particularly in mainline denominations, but this is even true in more and more evangelical churches as well, clericalism and professionalism of the ministry, so that it's no longer seen as the gift of the Holy Spirit flowing through a person with particular gifts. Pastoral gifts, according to scripture, are not universal caregiving gifts to do all the stuff that professional pastors have to do. No, it's a particular shepherd teacher in Ephesians. The Greek word is shepherd teacher. So you're looking after the well-being of souls and you're a teacher. And then there are other people with other spiritual gifts. So my experience, and this comes out of my background in the Pentecostal church before I became United Methodist, and this was a very positive experience. I was formed there to believe that everybody gets spiritual gifts from the Holy Spirit, and that the Holy Spirit is no respecter of persons. So you could be young or old. You could be well-educated or have learning disabilities or whatever. You could be any of these other markers that we use for people. And you're given a spiritual gift. And it's the church's job to respect that gift, to nurture it, and to allow that gift to shape the community of faith along with everybody else's gifts. So I have a theology of the body of Christ. I know it's really radical. And I have led small faith communities that I planted and co-planted with others, where you've got a team of people, 5 to 7 people who are on that lead team, who share responsibilities and teaching and, you know, according to our gifts, whatever we're doing. And when you've got a faith community of 25 to 40 people and you've got 5 to 7 people who are the leaders, that's not a full-time job. It's not even a part-time job. If we all work together, use our spiritual gifts, we can take turns going to the hospital and sitting with people. Even when I was a pastor of a traditional United Methodist church, I trained care teams with what I learned in seminary from my pastoral care classes. And we had, in a church where you had 85 people in worship, we had 12 people who were trained as lay chaplains that shared with all the visitation and everything.
Yeah.
And it worked.
I just preached, in air quotes, I actually did a little presentation about my spiritual harm and abuse research, sort of like a, more like an adult Sunday school class, mm-hmm. at a volunteer-run church. And I think there were like maybe 50, 60 people between the Zoom and in person. There were 2 doctors of psychology who were professors in Southern California, spoke with both of them afterward. And like, it's drawing really interesting people to that community. Uh-huh. And I was just reflecting on so much of the power dynamic stuff in the spiritual abuse research. And just like, they're kind of exempt from that. You know, uh-huh. a lot of those, the Mars Hill type thing is just impossible to happen at a church like this.
Yeah, that's right.
That's not the whole game. That's not the whole ball game, but it is a big part of it.
Uh-huh.
In terms of abuse stuff. Also, I was thinking, you know, with a client, for instance, I want my clients to have an outlet for service,
mm-hmm.
For values-driven service to something larger than themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So splitting up the job of 1 or 2 staff, 1 or 2 full-time staff people to 5 to 10 volunteer people means mm-hmm. that 5 to 10 people have a significant experience of service to a greater cause,
yes.
week in, week out, or at least month in, month out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's a gift. That's actually a gift. And none yeah. of those people are running a small business as like 20 hours of their week.
Right.
Right. Just keeping a little nonprofit going without much output other than keeping the building and the staff.
There
so that's all really interesting too. You know, again, it's not a silver bullet, but that is something that we lose. Like when you were talking about, I was thinking that in the Methodist situation, the congregants are basically outsourcing a bunch to the leadership
yeah.
rather than being challenged to take part in it themselves and probably having a more rewarding experience.
Yeah, much more rewarding and growing on to maturity
yeah.
because of the leadership roles and the serving roles. Yeah, I know many churches, in my conversations and working with people, I've encountered many churches of different sizes, but particularly larger churches with large professional staffs that are resistant to and threatened by the idea of equipping lay people for robust ministry. Because what that does then is calls into question, well, then what am I here for?
Hmm.
And that goes back to clericalism and clergy-centric models of church and thinking about what means a church is successful. This, you know, it's got an erudite professional up there at the front in the gated community behind the rail thing. And yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, we've got a fifth principle and we have just enough time to talk about it here. And this is that the church of the future uh-huh. needs communities of wounded healers. I recognize that term wounded healer from Henri Nouwen, the late French Canadian writer and pastor, author. Can you define wounded healer, first of all?
Yeah, a wounded healer, if we look at Nouwen, is somebody who is mindful of their own wounds and is attending to them. And out of tending to one's own wounds and healing, then what happens is that we become persons of compassion, empathy, through whom healing flows to other people. And we all have wounds. Some of us have way more wounds than others. It might be spiritual abuse. It might be sexual abuse. It could be any kind of violence, bullying, war trauma. I mean, we're in a very traumatized world. So a community of wounded healers is a faith community where we take the inward journey very seriously. And that includes not only learning practices of contemplative prayer and things like that, but also doing our work to heal. So, and that might mean therapy, it might mean medication, it could mean all sorts of things. If we understand that our role as a faith community is to be a healing community, which, by the way, the word salvation, the root word for that is Latin, it's salve, S-A-L-V-E, a healing ointment. And so the word salvation actually means to make things well again. And if we're going to be communities of salvation, communicating salvation and igniting salvation with cooperation with Christ in the world, then we have to attend to our wounds. One of the things that Henry Nouwen said is, if we don't do this, then we become wounded wounders. And other people have said this, you know, hurt people, and that kind of thing.
So, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that that might be therapy for people. And of course, my mind was sort of going that direction as well. But I would say that as someone who is becoming a therapist and training in this world, I do have clients right now, I'm doing therapy. Even stopping short of therapy, many therapeutic modalities, that is, many sort of theories of how healing and change happens and how disorder happens, focus on the idea that a lot of the problem is unprocessed pain of one sort or another, specifically emotion-focused therapy, but also cognitive approaches like cognitive processing therapy for trauma. Both of these would say you have to spend time with your pain, with your traumatic experiences, with your suffering, and that our mind has all kinds of ways of keeping us from doing that. And when we don't do that because it's scary or it's whatever, it's sensitive, then that leads to all these other symptoms, right? It also makes me think of AA and other 12-step groups where, and I have mixed thoughts about some of that in terms of healing from addiction, but something that I, in my limited experience with these groups, that I love is the non-judgmental sharing period.
Yeah.
That is a chance for people to process their pain, get it out there. They can say if they want advice or not, right? They can ask for it, but you don't give it. It's not a bunch of people. You're not allowed to manage your own anxiety by shutting someone else up. You're all in there together, sitting with the anxiety, sitting with the pain. And this is the kind of thing that I would probably see as a part of any sort of church model that I would work toward as well, is this idea of like, this is something that can, you know, some people need therapy, right? Like if you were sexually abused by your parents for 10 years, you are not going to want to just deal with that with a buddy. You know, that's, you're going to need to bring in the big guns. But but we can do so much in just like small groups can accomplish a ton of this if there are just a couple little rules that keep people from derailing it and making it about them or, you know, whatever. And you could borrow a lot of those rules from the 12-step groups, for instance. And that's like, that goes a long way to being a wounded healer of just processing it and being an ear for people, a non-judgmental, non-anxious presence. That gets me jazzed up.
Great. It gets me jazzed up too.
Great. And, okay, you know, we agree.
And the thing about it is, this is ancient. This is ancient. You find elements of this in the desert fathers and mothers, and, you know, all the way through. So I do think that we have much to learn from the 12-step communities about, especially the non-judgmental holding of space. And we have something to learn from Buddhist tradition too, about the mindful practices, mindfulness,
100%.
Where we're noticing what's going on inside ourselves.
They go hand in hand. You can't process the pain if you don't know what pain you're feeling.
Exactly.
It's oftentimes with clients, I'll start with mindfulness. It's like, what do you want? What are you feeling? And then once we can name it, okay, now can we sit with that or not, you know, or whatever. But you got to know what it is first. So they're, to me, they're birds of a feather.
I also think that in our spirituality, we have something to learn from this emerging field of somatic healing of trauma, that how we hold the trauma in our bodies, because part of the dysfunction of the church, definitely the Western church, you know, this is what we've inherited, is this sort of disembodied religion. And we have to honor our bodies again, and the wisdom and the epistemological role our bodies play, right? And so all of these practices and this wisdom is coming to us from these different directions. So this is part of what's going to help us become communities of wounded healers.
Dr. Elaine Heath, I'm just going to give you one more shot. Anything else you'd like to leave us with? I'm not going to talk anymore. I would imagine that this is in the 98th percentile of how much interviewers have talked while interviewing you in your career. It did. I just couldn't resist today. Too many interesting overlaps.
Well, yeah, it's been great to talk to you. I really enjoyed it. I think what I want to say is you can do this. We can do this. And we must do this. This is a call of the Spirit. This is what the Spirit is saying to the church. And if I'll say something that my mentor said to me years ago when I recognized a call to ministry, she said, if you will say yes to God, God will open way. So if we'll say yes to God, and that's been my experience, if we'll say yes to God, this is how we want to be in the world as the church, then God will show us how to do it and give us the courage and the stamina.
Well, I also want to say a quick thank you to the listener, Judy Gale, for introducing me to you. She sent me a talk of yours that was around these 5 points. And I was like, that's great. It's also perfect episode fodder to have like a little listicle. It breaks it up nicely. I just find that I wish it didn't work, but it really works. So thank you to Judy for recommending Elaine. And we're all grateful and better off for it. And I've got a link in the show notes to your website, as well as the two books you mentioned as indigenous resources, Rescuing the Gospel from the Cowboys and Braiding Sweetgrass. Thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome. It's been a joy.
If you're listening to this podcast, you must recognize the value of asking questions. At Aramco, our questions help us engineer a better future. How can today's resources fuel our shared tomorrow? How can we deliver energy to a world that can't stop? How can we deliver one of the fuels of the future? How can we sow curiosity to harvest ingenuity? To learn more about how innovation drives us forward, visit aramco.com/poweredbyhow.